And actually today, I just want to talk briefly about what those specific recommendations to this committee are. If I may, refer you now to the item in your book that starts with a yellow page that looks like this, Department of Higher Education Budget Structure. I'd just like to introduce some terms and talk a little bit about how the department's budget is structured, because it's easy, if you don't have this in the back of your mind, to get lost, because the department has so many different activities and so many different functions. And there are some terms here that are useful to know as people talk and discuss what is going on in this particular agency. What this yellow sheet shows is it shows 9 different program areas or budget areas of the Department of Higher Education. There are 8 on the first page, and there's 1 on the back of the first page. Each of these are budgeted separately by the Legislative Assembly, which means that funds that you appropriate or allow to be spent in one of these boxes, the department cannot switch funds between the boxes. You determine how much goes into each box. If there's an emergency, the emergency board would have some authority during the interim to switch money between boxes. But the department itself is not, under law, allowed to do that. So if we look at each of these boxes, if we start at the first one in the upper left, the first budget area is known as the Education and General Program area. This is probably what most people think of when they think of higher education. I mean, most people would probably think entirely of this and may not think of these other things unless they look into it more deeply. Because what the Education and General Budget finances is it finances the education, research, and public service activities of the 7 Oregon University System campuses and the centralized activities of the Chancellor's Office. This is funded by general fund, by tuition and fees, by research grants and gifts, and the budget amounts to a total of $2.3 billion. All of these numbers are in the governor's original recommended budget. If it's still not clear after that description what is in the education in general and what isn't, it's probably best to go on and see what isn't in there so you can see what's left, you know, in education in general. But the next program to the right on the first row is the fee remission program. The fee remission is a program that finances tuition reductions or waivers for students under a number of programs. It doesn't include all of the financial aid that would be awarded by a particular campus because it doesn't include scholarships, for example. But there are programs that allow students who meet certain conditions to pay less in tuition than is the, quote, sticker price. And this is funded entirely from the tuition and fees and is budgeted at $61 million. So these are funds that are not available or are not spent to provide or support specific programs that the system is offering. Instead, they go back to students in the form of reduced tuition costs. And we'll be looking at that.
Senator Drew, do these flow through each of the institutions, or does the Chancellor's Office handle them, or how does it work?
The tuition is now maintained at the campus level, and therefore the campuses do provide the fee remissions, though there are the State Board of Higher Education adopts the policies that govern the fee remission programs. So it's really a campus-based, you know, it's run at the campus level with some centralized oversight.
Okay, so when this money is distributed, does it all go to the chancellor and then he distributes it to the institutions, or how does it work?
No, it does not work that way, and I would actually need a little help with this because this is a new program that was not budgeted separately this way last biennium. But I believe that what the chancellor does, the chancellor's office, authorizes in the budget campuses to have certain levels of fee remissions, and then they can apply up to that amount of fee remissions for qualifying students that enroll from their tuition fees.
Everybody is nodding yes, so I think it must be yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Question for
Representative Smith.
Yes. How are the students then chosen for this? Is it based on need, like a need grant?
In some cases, it is based on need. In other cases, it's not. It's based on other policies of the institutions. And I can get you a list of these theory mission programs, which would be helpful.
That would be fine. Thank you, Steve.
Yes, Representative Schrader, for Alpha. Are we going to get a separate presentation on this area?
You will be getting a separate presentation on tuition policies, which will include, as a part of it, a presentation on the theory missions.
Follow-up question then at that time. Obviously, we need some background. And one of the questions is, why do we not collect that tuition and cut the tuition up front rather than collect it and then redistribute it?
Yeah.
That's a question.
Okay, that's a good question. I want to know also, Steve, on the theory mission program, $61 million. Is that included in the $2.3 billion?
No, that's on top of that.
That's in addition to the $2.3 billion. Okay. Well, continue.
The next three program areas, the Agricultural Experiment Station, the Extension Service, and the Forest Research Laboratory, are often combined and called the statewide public service programs. All three of these programs are operated by Oregon State University. And they are separately budgeted for, and the boxes there explain what these budgets support. The Agricultural Experiment Station budget finances research programs in agricultural and environmental sciences. Even though it's a small portion of the higher ed budget at $111 million, just in comparison, that's approximately the size of the State Scholarship Commission budget that you just finished working on. So, you know, it's a very substantial budget. The fund sources are the general fund, the Hatch Act federal funds, grants, contracts, and sales. The Extension Service is also housed at OSU, and this program finances educational outreach programs and applied research throughout the state with focuses on resource industries, you know, farming, fishing, agriculture, nutrition, and youth. It's funded by general fund, by the Smith-Lever federal funds, county funds, and sales and fees. And the Forest Research Laboratory finances research in forestry and wood processing. It's financed by general fund, federal funds, grants, and the state's forest products harvest tax. The next program area is the Sports Action Lottery. It's financed by an actual lottery game, the Sports Action Lottery game, and it supports, I didn't say finances, because there's a lot of other finances for these programs, but it supports intercollegiate athletic programs and graduate student scholarships. The fund source is the lottery, and it's $5.3 million. The next program area is debt service, which finances the debt, on bonds issued for capital construction and on certificates of participation. The fund sources are housing and dining fees, because some of these bonds are issued to build they're not called dormitories anymore, I'm dating myself, housing facilities and dining facilities. And some of them are financed by student building fees, the general fund, rent payments, and debt service amounts to $90 million per biennium.
Residence hall.
Okay, yes. Thank you. The next box is dark. It's colored in dark because you're not actually going to be working on this particular program area yet. It's in a separate bill, Senate Bill 5525, which you'll be scheduled to look at later in the session. But this is the capital construction budget for higher education, which finances the construction and acquisition of higher education facilities and academic modernization and repair. It's financed by bonds, gifts and grants, and general fund, and the governor's proposing $209 million there.
Steve, since you do have that figure, $209 million, Senate Bill 5525 obviously has a list of the... what's academic modernization? Does that relate to programs at all, or is that
no
physical?
That relates to maintaining facilities in their current state of repair and modernizing in the sense of upgrading, say, classrooms or better seating, better lighting, maybe internet connectivity,
right.
Those types
How
of
about
things.
Equipment?
And equipment.
Okay.
In the
sure. Okay.
Finally, on page 2, there's what's known as the non-limited program. What the non-limited program is, it finances what are known as auxiliary activities that are essentially run on a self-support basis. And these include student housing, food services, parking, athletics, student government, health centers. These types of things are all within the non-limited program. And the fund sources here include student fees, sales and service fees could be for residence halls, dining halls, incidental fees for student government, building fees for construction of certain facilities, sales and service charges, and non-credit continuing education. This is budgeted at $757 million. So the total budget there, shown at the bottom of the page, you can see the general fund supplies 21% of that budget. Lottery, when you round to the nearest percent, is at zero. It's only the sports action lottery. The other funds are 27%, and actually most of the funds are non-limited funds at almost $1.9 billion.
Maybe it's non-limited.
If I could, Mr. Chair members, go briefly and look at the next page, which is sort of on the brown colored sheet. I'd like to mention a few recommendations that the Joint Legislative Audit Committee made to this committee that you should consider as you hear this budget and you work on it later on next month. These are listed in the order that the report made the recommendations. But if I could, I would start with number 2 and end with number 1, because number 1 sort of is more a process thing and covers the other ones as well. Number 2, recommendation 2, was that if there were faculty recruitment and retention funding that was being requested, the recommendation was that that OUS would present criteria for how they would distribute those funds and how those funds were being used. This recommendation is actually moot, though. These recommendations were made before the budget came forward because they're not requesting any funds for faculty recruitment or retention this time around. So you can sort of just ignore number 2 for now. Number 3 talks about proposed resource allocation model adjustments. And the recommendation of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee is that OUS shall list all proposed substantial adjustments to the budget model and specify the fiscal impact to each campus and to centralized OUS operations of each proposed adjustment. This is very important in this particular budget cycle because the governor's recommendation includes or requires major changes in or major adjustments to the resource allocation model. And the JLAC report recommendation is that you require higher ed to report back to you how they would implement these changes, how they would adjust their model, and how each of the campuses would be affected. Also, to the extent that you are able or have funds available to restore cuts that the governor made or to fund programs that the governor did not fund, this would again apply. OUS would be expected to tell you how your decisions are impacting campus budgets and centralized operation budgets. Recommendation 4 requires a tuition report that the Oregon University System shall report on tuition revenue and policy. The report shall highlight changes in tuition policies and include projection for tuition revenue by category and projections for fee remissions. This is also very important in this budget cycle because, as you know, in the governor's recommended budget, there is a tuition increase. And the governor has asked the State Board of Higher Education to look at the issues relating to that tuition increase and to come back with a proposal as to how tuitions should be adjusted within the parameters of his budget. So this tuition report would require that information be presented. Number five, any adjustments that the Oregon University System made to its budget resource allocation model since the last session, they'll be required to report on those and the impacts that they made to the campuses. And finally, if I can go back to number one, the resource allocation model, the Ways and Means Committee, the recommendation is that you should include your expectations concerning the resource allocation model in the budget report and require the Department of Higher Ed to submit an explanation of how it's interpreting your expectations prior to your final action on the budget bill. What this is saying is, this is saying that JLAC found there were some problems of communication between Ways and Means and Higher Ed in the last budget cycle, and this is a proposal or a recommendation to help minimize those. So basically, you'll have certain expectations when you're ready to pass the budget out. You'll have certain expectations as to what programs are being cut, what programs are not being cut, what programs are being enhanced. And the recommendation is for you to indicate clearly what your expectations are, ask Higher Ed to respond to see if they have the same expectations before you actually move the budget out. So after things are done, hopefully this will minimize situations after the session's over where the legislature finds, you know, is surprised about how things are happening.
Senator Charles,
Chair. I think it's one of the phenomena of centralization, decentralization. We encourage, with the new budget model, a great deal of decentralization, a lot of authority on each individual campus, campus differences based on entrepreneurial activities and other kinds of things. And yet when we budget, we give a centralized budget to the entire system with sort of expectations around a centralized budget without realizing that a lot of things that we thought could be easily done by the state system can't be so easily done as you look at the vagaries of each campus. And that, I think, is part of the problem.
Thank you, Senator. And I'd like to add to that also is that, you know, we absolutely must find a way to have accountability. I know that's a tired phrase these days, but that is key to it. The public money invested, we have to account for it, and it is management problems.
I just want to get a push and pull of what we tell higher education to do. Be more entrepreneurial, be more individual, venture out, do things each campus, don't be all the same. And then we pull them back and say, but you got to be accountable and you got to do it just the way we want you to do it. And those two things don't always fit.
Okay. Steve?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Close, yes.
Thank you. Steve, in this green document, this JLAC committee, in the back you've got an index, response of Department of Higher Education. Then there's a letter, short letter in the very back, and they make reference to their comments on the report, but the comments aren't here. Are they somewhere in our
report? We can get you copies of those.
Okay. I'd like to see them.
Sure.
Let me write that down.
Okay, Steve.
Okay. Because of time, you know, lack of time, I won't be going through the rest of this material right now. But you can see I've included information on the budget notes that were approved last session, which the department will be commenting on, as well as some slides to give some basic information of how higher ed has been funded over the past several biennia, basically since the implementation of Measure 5. And there'll be discussions on that later in the presentation, not today, but in the future on that as well. The final sheet I just want to comment about is a separate sheet that has a list of the program enhancements and cuts in the governor's recommended budget. It's probably in the same pile where your green report was, the JLAC report. It's a one-page sheet. And this just very briefly summarizes what the was in the governor's budget, or the original budget that he proposed in December. And what I've done here is I've broken it out into the education in general program area and into the statewide public services. And there'll be a lot of discussion on this later in the next couple weeks. But There are basically two enhancements in the governor's budget for new or expanded programs. There's $20 million for expansions in engineering education, and there's $7.2 million to open up a branch campus in Central Oregon in Bend. Those total enhancements amount to $27.2 million. That's all general fund. There are also some enhancements to the what I'm calling the base programs. That's to say, these aren't new programs. These are the existing programs that higher ed is funding. And those are the following. There are $17 million for enrollment growth. That money, you'll look into ways of distributing that money, but that money could essentially be used simply to offset reductions that are elsewhere in the budget. There's $8 million to increase the proportion of funding that is going to the four smallest campuses. That's Western, Eastern, Southern, and OIT. Both the Joint Legislative Audit Committee and the system itself came to the conclusion that the RAM model as it had been working was underfunding those four institutions relative to the other institutions in the system. The governor also includes $25.2 million in tuition increases that could be used to fund the base programs. Those are not general fund, those are other funds, but those are, you know, dollars that can be used to support base programs. So there's a total of $50.2 million in new funding for base programs.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Troll.
Just a question about the tuition increase, the 25.2. It was sort of unclear to me whether that money was assigned basically to be used in higher ed's budget or whether it was a tuition amount of money that went into the general fund and could be assigned over the entire budget. Is it specified that this is money that will be spent in the higher ed budget?
Yes, this is money, this is tuition that would remain with higher education. It would not be transferred to the general fund.
I'm glad to have that clear.
Right.
I don't think it's been clear.
Yeah.
Okay. The cuts, though, this budget has large cuts to the education and general programs. There are $69.8 million in cuts, which will be going over in some detail later on in this presentation, which leaves a net, if you look at the base, I'm looking at the three rows that are shaded. You have to exclude the enhancements because those funds can't be used against these $69.8 million cuts. But the $50.2 million can be applied against the $69.8 million to leave a net reduction of $19.6 million in the education and general program. For the statewide public services, governor's budget cuts $15.1 million. And there aren't any offsetting enhancements, and they don't get any tuition monies. So basically, the cut remains at $15.1 million. This sheet includes another $12 million in costs that are not counted in higher ed's current service level, which we'll discuss when we talk about the Higher Education Efficiency Act.
Okay. All right. You done?
I'm done.
Okay, thank you. Nice presentation. Joe Cox, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joe Cox. I'm chancellor of the university system and have been in this position since 1994. Prior to that, I was president of the university in Ashland. What we're going to do today and tomorrow is to provide at about the 30,000 foot level an overview based on, it builds on what Steve has already done, and we pretty much follow the outline that he suggested to us that we follow. So today we're talking with you about mission and goals and this organizational structure. We'll be talking about programs and services, strategic planning, and we'll conclude this afternoon with some opinion work done for us by Davis and Hibbets, which will give you a sense and sampling of a public opinion with respect to the university system. As I said, tomorrow we'll conclude that overview, and then beginning on Thursday of this week, we get into more specifics, and then as we start to drill down over the next 2 weeks into individual areas. The transparencies on the screen, I think you have in hard copy, and I won't turn around to continue to look at them. I'll just assume that the magic fingers of a trustee associate will keep that reasonably in touch with where I am. But she reminds me that three sessions ago when we first did this, we went through 60 slides, and I said, and Nancy, could we now have the pink slide? And behind me there was this consternation, what pink slide? So hasn't let me forget that. Steve said it very well. This is a complex, multifaceted, multi-mission organization. It has a significant teaching component. That's the education in general part of the budget that Steve spoke to. It has a significant research component, both for our own purposes and for Oregon. We are approximately a $200 million a year clean industry that if we didn't exist, you would have the Department of Economic Development go out and create. And that's a major part of our function. It's part of our teaching as well as the service role we play. And one of the areas that I will spend some time on with you later is the service side of the university system, which you may not know as much about. So, to put it in the largest possible context, there are 7 campuses, 2 university centers, which are not quite campuses, but which are partnerships in conjunction with community colleges, one on the coast and one in Central Oregon. There are roughly 143 sites across the state where some segment of the university system is delivering a service. That may be a teaching center, it could be the extension office, it could be the experiment station, it could be an element of the university engineering program out of Oregon State or Portland State. Some 98,000 students that you would typically think of when you and I talked about students. Steve gave himself away at referring to dormitories. I thought he was going to refer to boys and girls dorms and go on from there. But 98,000 students that you and I would typically think of as being college students, scattered on campuses ranging from 17,000 down to about 2,000. There are 3 large doctoral universities, University of Oregon, Portland State, and Oregon State. There's a polytechnic, that's OIT, and we'll talk about that later. That's a different kind of institution, a very applied technology institution over in Klamath Falls, but also with branches in Portland. And then there are 3 essentially undergraduate universities with some master's degree programs, Western in Monmouth, Southern Oregon in Ashland, and Eastern Oregon in LeGrand. And from those 7 bases and the 2 university centers and the 143 other sites, we cover the state. But in addition to the 98,000 students who are typically traditional students, there are just under 100,000 other students who you never hear very much about. They're taking non-credit coursework through the Extension Service. They're taking a short-term course from OCATE, the Center for Engineering Technology Education in Beaverton. It's an engineer upgrading her certificate or a nurse doing the same. Almost 100,000 of those students. Then there are probably another 150,000 Oregonians who in one way or another are touched by the university system, either through the Extension Service, the experimentation, or in direct coursework. What I'd like to do now is recite just very quickly, I won't go through this slide completely, but this is the mission of higher education as you will find it in statute. It's changed over the years since 1930, but this is basically essentially it, and it translates down to instruction, research, and public service. And with that, Chairman Hartung, members of the committee, I'd like to have you meet the president of our board, Don Van Luveny. Don, in his other life, is the CEO of Electroscientific Instruments in Beaverton, which is a multi-state, multinational organization based here in Oregon. And he spends a lot of time with the Board for Higher Education. He has brought a real sense of looking at things differently, as engineers always do. And with no more introduction than that, I'd like to introduce my boss, Don Van Luveny.
Thank you, Joe.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Just for the record, I am Don Van Luveny. I'm president and CEO of Electro Scientific Industries, Oregon's oldest technology company, and current president of the State Board of Higher Education. I welcome the opportunity to speak to the committee today about the mission of the Oregon Public Universities and the goals and priorities we share for the campuses of the Oregon University System. As you know, the mission of our state universities is the product of legislative direction and foresight over many years. It encompasses a vision that seeks extended educational opportunity for our children beyond the formative years of primary and secondary education. The intent now, as always, is to help our young people prepare to take their place in the future of our state, its professions, and its institutions by nurturing their educational experience in ways that will allow them to reach their full potential as citizens and contributing members of society. Our mission weaves a tapestry of helping individuals to develop critical skills and technical knowledge in science and the professions, and strengthens the fabric with the intellectual, culture, and social trends that shape the garment of an educated individual. Further, it is our mission to create and pass on the body of knowledge for future generations and to provide the state of Oregon and its citizens the essential instructional, research, and public services that serve to support the state's economy and enrich the lives of all Oregonians. Since 1997, the State Board of Higher Education has sought to fulfill the mission by thoughtfully and enthusiastically working to achieve a series of four student-centered and performance-based goals and priorities. These goals are, number one, to expand and provide greater access, greater opportunity for citizens of our state to benefit from the personal experience of higher education. We see in that goal the responsibility to extend the opportunity by all means possible, by both traditional and non-traditional means, to all regions of our state, including parts that have historically been underserved by higher education, and to all people, particularly those underrepresented populations who deserve equal opportunity and access. Number two, to build quality into all of our programs and services. It is not enough to simply provide these programs and services. To truly help young people succeed and to help our state advance, we must ensure quality in all of our efforts. We need to pursue the highest standards in intellectual matters to push forward new frontiers in research and to bring the state of the art into the experience of our students and future Oregon leaders. Number three, to enhance the employability of our graduates and leverage our educational resources in ways that significantly contribute to Oregon's economic development. We live in a global marketplace, and we must do all that we can to utilize our educational resources for the benefit of Oregon's future. Our citizens need skill and knowledge and understanding to compete and to make Oregon competitive. Number four, to manage our enterprise with the highest level of cost effectiveness and fiscal integrity, we recognize a unique trust, and we must continue to ensure the citizens of this state that we are doing our utmost to maximize their investment in public higher education. As we look to the next biennium and beyond, our priorities as a State Board of Higher Education are focused on the following six essential priorities. Number one, enabling more Oregonians to obtain a higher education. Our state is growing, and with that growth comes the need to avail higher educational opportunities to more citizens. We are graduating greater numbers of high school students each year who are ready for college. And we are attracting in-migration from families and professionals who require additional education to enhance their skills and knowledge in the workplace. This year, our public universities have set a new record for enrollment, and we need to sustain that ability to serve more on into the future. Number two, broader access. It's our priority to provide the opportunity for students and professionals anywhere, anyplace, anytime. The kind of thinking requires us to broaden our horizons, to think about educational delivery in terms that minimize the barriers of distance, time, location, and price. Number three, a priority is to improve progress towards graduation and degrees. Our priority is to streamline the systems that impede individual progress and slow the process towards graduation. Number four, another priority is to award more degrees in disciplines that are critical to this state and its future. That means teachers for our schools, teachers in disciplines like special education, bilingual education, science, mathematics, counseling, and others. That means graduates in computer science and engineering to fill the jobs that now exist in our state's largest industry, jobs that often attract applicants from other states because there are not enough Oregonian graduates to fill the vacancies. That means bioscience and other disciplines that are emerging to shape Oregon's future. Number five, to improve graduate performance on standardized professional examinations. Our graduates do well on professional licensure examinations, but we can do better. And finally, number six, the final priority really says it all. Our priority is to enable more graduates of the Oregonian university system to build their lives here in Oregon. When we lose our graduates to jobs in other states, we not only lose the advantage of our investment in their education, we lose the advantage of their talent, leadership potential, and their understanding of what makes Oregon unique and special to this world. We need to place more Oregonians in well-paying, family-enriching jobs throughout our state. That must be a priority for all of us, but particularly the Oregon University system. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have of the board and its missions and goals.
Thank you, Don. For one, I certainly do appreciate the work that you and other members of the board have done, particularly since ballot measure 5. We really have our work cut out for us, and I do feel that we're making improvements in quality now, and I just hope we can restore cuts that have been made. We made such good progress last session, but all we have to do is find the money, and I'm sure there's agreement to do that. But thank you so much, and please extend that thanks to the rest of your board members, too. Other questions or comments from the members? No? Thank you, Don.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay. You'll hear from several other members of the board.
Excuse me.
Yeah, this afternoon.
Senator Cobb.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh.
I did want to say that we have a lot of folks in the audience who are supporters of higher education, and I know we welcome them here. There's some members of the League of Women Voters who are here, and they and the AAUW are having a day in the Capitol today, and I know we welcome them, and I know they have an interest in education.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator, and welcome, ladies. Nice to have you here.
Bill? Senator Hartung, members of the committee, our next task is to bring into an understandable focus the organization that is responsible for this 500,000 student organization and structure that we are responsible for stretching across the state. And I've asked Vice Chancellor Tom Andrus, who has joined us this year as our Chief Administrative and Financial Officer. I lured Tom here from Nevada with promises of good skiing and full lakes and water skiing, and I'm going to have to eat some of those words, I think. I'm considering putting roller skates on my sailboat. Tom served in Nevada as chancellor, but his real heart is with the administration and finance side, and he's brought some really, I think, sound thinking to our effort. And with that, I'd like to ask him to take us through the organizational structure of the enterprise. And at any time, my colleague to the left, Satish, is free to comment. Huh?
Thank you, Chancellor.
Do you want to be known as Thomas or Tom? Tom? Okay.
Tom, Senator, yes. My name is Tom Andrews, Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration with the university system here in Oregon. When you begin to look at what should be the next slide on administrative organization, enrollment, major divisions, it doesn't sound real exciting. And what we'll do is, I think, as had been discussed earlier, this is an orientation, so this will be very high level, and we'll just try to hit some high points. The OUS administrative organization is comprised of, you've just heard from the lead individual on the board. There's 11 board members. They are appointed by the governor. Two of those members are students. They really provide the primary direction, policy, that we then, through the system, communicate to the universities as they are dealing with policies, dealing with administrative programs, dealing with budget, dealing with the whole array of issues in higher education. And one issue that I think Senator Hartung raised a little bit earlier that we'll be talking a lot about is trying to find that balance between accountability and autonomy. As we've been moving farther and farther and providing more autonomy, there is, I think, kind of a continuing need to make sure that we, the legislature, the governor, and others are understanding of how the funding is being spent, and we see that as one of our major tasks. Looking at enrollments, and again, Chancellor Cox has spoken to this, you're going to see different types of enrollments, and on one hand, I want to apologize for that, and on another hand, that's unfortunately the way higher ed is. We're looking at, in this case, a fall enrollment, which is a very typical enrollment, which is credit only, and it's headcount. And we'll try to define that at a later point when we really start talking about the budget. But this is a particularly important measure because it really looks at a large number of students using the services. And the next slide will tell us a little bit different story. But this really is talking about the students that are taking classes both on the campuses and extended and using the services, student services, library services, and so forth. As you can see, it has been there has been continuous growth from 94. We are right at about 70,000 in the year 2000, and we, as you will see in the next slide, are looking at even further growth given where the Oregon High School population is going. As we look at the next chart on FTE, FTE is another way of looking at enrollments, looking at demand. This is going to be particularly important as we come back and talk to the committee about the budget, because the budget model is built on full-time equivalent enrollment. So we'll be defining that a little bit more. But the main point here is, again, growth. We're talking about 1990 at approximately 60,000 full-time equivalent enrollments and seeing that rise to over 70,000 over the next 10 or so years. And again, just to give you a sense of the demand that's out there for the services that we're providing. In all cases, this relates only to what would be funded and credit-based higher ed. What Chancellor Cox mentioned earlier in terms of 200 plus thousand other non-credit enrollment, that will be rising as well. Those demands will be out there too.
Excuse me, Tom. You mentioned 1990, 60,000. You meant 1999.
1999 to 2000. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And this question is for Joe. Joe, when OHSU became a public corporation, how did that change the enrollment figures that we're looking at here?
Senator Hartung, it's been a while since I've looked at those numbers. Shirley Clark is here. I want to say that the OHSU enrollment on the Hill,
yes,
apart from our pre-med, pre-nursing activity, was something in the neighborhood of 1,500 to 1,600 students. Shirley is saying a couple of thousand.
Okay.
Give me, Senator.
So that's pretty incredible when we cut them out, 95 or 96, we still have...
Actually, it was just before 94.
Okay. And another thing, if the legislature approves the merging of OHSU and OGI, what will that do to the enrollment of the system approximately?
Well, Senator, those numbers wouldn't be counted in our base anyway.
Okay.
And I can't tell you off the top of my head the total OGI enrollment. I should know it, and I've got it, but I just don't have it in my mind.
Okay. Well, yeah,
it's all, of course, at the graduate
correct
level, mm-hmm, master's and doctoral.
Okay, thank you. Proceed, Tom.
Thank you. The next slide, the question was raised, what is the process through which we go in terms of, or the categorization of our budgets? And what we've provided here is what is a very typical nationally accepted structure for categorizing our programs and the associated costs. It provides a really very good vehicle for us to make comparisons with other universities. And again, when we start talking about the RAM and the budget model and where we're going with that, that is built on costs derived from peers as well as our own actual expenditures. So this structure where we're talking about instruction, research, public service, these are the primary areas that we are doing a variety of pieces of our higher education. Instruction, obviously, is the lion's share of that in terms of relative to all of the other functions. Approximately 50% of our costs are through instruction in our statewide budget. Student services, your library, academic support, physical plant are all areas that we ultimately right now are tracking and making comparisons relative to other institutions, and as we start talking about performance more and more in the future, that will be a primary benchmark for us is using that structure. And the final slide that I will be dealing with, and again, we'll be bringing this back in more detail later, is the budget development process. The process that we have is, as we've stated a little earlier, is really built on the board's priorities. The board establishes priorities from which we then go forward to the various universities, talk about where we're going with engineering or other enhancements, and utilize that as the basis for our budget decision-making process, where there is a significant amount of coordination that takes place in the process with the governor's office and the initiatives that they have, the timing, the structure, and also, I think, as Mr. Bender has mentioned, there are budget notes, there are a number of pieces that we must also acknowledge as part of our budget process flowing from the legislature. That moves through as part of our budget process as well. One component that will be very important that we'll talk to that was raised a little bit earlier was on tuition policy. We feel very strongly that as much as there is a state commitment in funding, there is a student commitment as well. And we are in the process right now of looking at what the commitment we think is that it's appropriate. Again, we look at peer institutions. We do a variety of things. But that will be part of the discussion that we have with you actually in about 1 week. And then at that point, when the board has all of that information, there are a number of meetings that they go through where they literally debate the issues. They'll have the presidents making presentations, we'll offer recommendations, and then in the end they provide a final recommendations that are developed and modeled into the governor's budget and goes forward. That is a very quick overview of a number of issues.
Thank you, Tom. I think we're going to get along just fine. How long were you at the University of Nevada?
I was at the Nevada system for about 6 years.
What did you do before that?
I was the deputy commissioner for finance for the state of Connecticut.
Mm. And then one time we were together in Arizona.
Yeah, we were in Arizona. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
I'm a lot older than I look. No, it's good to be here. It really is.
Well, thank you. You're certainly welcome. You have a critical role. I don't know. I haven't heard Joe say this for a while, but when I came back to the legislature 6 years ago after being gone 14 years, why, one of the things that I always remember Joe saying was that our university system will be customer-oriented. Our customers are our students. And Joe, do you feel like we're still moving in that direction?
Yes, sir. Okay. I really do.
Don Van Leeuwenhoek, do you think so also? Good. I would think you would be, yeah, because you know if you don't take care of your customers, you're gone. You're out of business. So
we hear that sermon pretty regularly.
That's good. Well, thank you, Tom.
Thanks.
Joe?
A change of pace now. Shirley Clark is no stranger to the legislature. She came to us from Minnesota, the University of Minnesota, where she was vice president and dean of a major college. She's been our chief academic officer since the middle 1990s, and she'll be joined by President Dan Bernstein from Portland State and Sean Hempel, who is a student board member. Sean is a student at OIT, and Dan comes to us from the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah. Welcome to the committee. Shirley, are you the leadoff?
I am, Senator Hartung. For the record, my name is Shirley Clark, and I'm Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs. And my assignment for today is to talk about major educational services along with my colleagues here, again at the 35,000 foot level, and we do promise more details in the days to come. So I'd like to talk briefly and rather generally about the primary academic service areas and also about primary student service areas, and note a few areas where things are changing pretty dramatically from the kind of educational experience that a lot of us have had in the past. We have also provided in your notebooks two reports that we'll make occasional reference to today, and these will come up again and again. One of these is the report on implementation of Senate Bill 919. It probably follows the paper slide material in day one, and it looks like this. This would be the second of these reports. And I think Senator Hartung will recall that 919 was a product of the Senate Education Committee in 1997. And through it, we have an opportunity to report in six areas. But we will be doing that by the by here. And the other is a report that I think we have done perhaps now three times called Faculty Work and Results Productivity Review, in which we try to put together in one place some of the information, often in response to the frequently asked questions about the faculty, what do they do, and about teaching and learning. So some of what I'll say is drawn from that, and throughout the course of our presentations, there will be occasional reference to these materials. I have also brought, and we could provide additional copies, but this may be a little bit intimidating, just by the weight of it. This is the reference material on which the 919 report is built. So I'll bequeath this to Mr. Bender and be happy to provide other sets should they be requested. Well, we have already indicated our perspective that our state is shifting from an industrial society to an information society that puts a premium on intellectual capital, on knowledge and the people who produce it, learn it, and apply it. Hand in hand with this demand for increased levels of education comes the need for more education and more frequent infusions of education that is now called just-in-time education, because it does seem that the shelf life of knowledge is shorter than it used to be, and that creates this demand for rather continual education and training. About instruction, we've indicated what our enrollment is and how that has grown in credit courses and in non-credit experiences, most of which we would probably agree are also educational experiences. Students have their choice of something like 550 different majors, which are offered at multiple sites, particularly at the undergraduate level. So our program inventory is actually quite a bit larger than that, and I'll talk to you briefly tomorrow about that and the adjustments we made over the last decade. Teaching is done by about 3,200 ranked instructional faculty, and about three-fourths of those faculty members are full-time. The rest of the faculty then would consist of adjuncts and in lesser proportion of teaching assistants. Teaching and learning is changing, both on campus and off, in some similar ways, largely due to the internet and technology. So this is not limited to distance education and those sites that we're using video-based services or internet services to deliver education. We have created a one-stop site. We call this the Oregon Network for Education, and along with this, we've created a web-based catalog that can be accessed that enables Oregonians of any age to pursue their educational objectives. We've worked with the community colleges and also with the independent colleges that are interested in creating this over the past 2 years. And we list there something like 2,500 courses, within 75 degree programs that are offered by 22 institutions. Many faculty are developing web-based courses. They are doing this on their own, many of them, just because they're interested in experimenting with a new technology and learning new skills. Some of them are doing this through the support of grants, largely federal grants. And we do have one of the federal grants through the Chancellor's Office that is supporting the rather large-scale, more than 100 courses into a web-based format. Some of our campuses are creating academic support centers to help faculty move their traditionally based courses into courses that have some technology aspects to them. At University of Oregon, for example, there is a Teaching with Technology Center that supports faculty in this effort, and it is by no means the only campus that is assisting in that way. A word about research, and again, you'll hear more about this in days to come. Our faculty, and particularly faculty at Oregon State, Portland State, University of Oregon, are expected to engage in scholarly work and creative activities that result in something. That may be a creative product. A music faculty member might produce a recital, an art faculty member an exhibit. Very often, this is a different kind of product, a discovery, an invention, a piece of software, publication, maybe simply a better way of doing something. Much of this work, by no means all, but much of this work attracts outside funds, federal funds or philanthropic funds, to support the research or the clinical trials, the demonstrations, whatever it might be required for the research. Our total research dollars attracted this past year amounted to approximately $203 million. And to try to make that number more meaningful, if we averaged it for the faculty members, the ranked faculty members, we would have something like $86,000 per faculty member, and this is well more than the average faculty salary. So it is a very important source of revenue for us, accessing external support in support of the research activities of the faculty, but even beyond that, to enable us to purchase equipment, library resources, and other materials. We could give, and as you hear from our presidents and other reporters over the next several days, you will hear a lot about the research that's being done, but I'll just mention three. President Bernstein may move into this in his presentation. Many faculty are engaged in research on school reform and student learning proficiencies. In the Chancellor's Office, for example, we have had a series of federal grants and philanthropic grants through the 1990s, and very recently, University of Oregon obtained a large Pew grant to continue this kind of work. At the School of Pharmacy at Oregon State, the delivery system was invented for time-release medications, which we can appreciate is a very important type of discovery. University of Oregon, there is a National Science Foundation-funded project that supports the development of a wind tunnel to measure turbulence, which, as frequent air travelers, we can appreciate, contributes to we hope the safety we would come to expect. And so it goes, and you will hear many, many more examples of these kinds of contributions. Public service is a third and very important function of faculty in terms of the educational services that are delivered and of our staff. They enable us to apply and extend expertise to almost all areas of life that you can think about, family, health, business, education, the environment, through laboratories and clinics, museums, libraries, observatories, athletic events, conferences, and individual consultations by faculty members and their students, special assistance is given. And often it's a research base that forms the fund of information from which the faculty member can apply a potential solution or an answer to a problem. And just thinking about some recent examples of public service, we would think about Portland State Center for Population Research and the Census. Almost every day, we are learning a lot about what is coming from the U.S. Census 2000, and much of the Oregon information has been analyzed by the Population Research and Census Center. At University of Oregon, the Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior consults both nationally and locally on practical and effective ways to attempt to make schools safer places for students and for staff. We have several small business development centers. I'll select out here the one at Southern Oregon that provides business counseling to scores of clients, business owners in Jackson and Josephine counties. At Oregon State, we have one prototype program for middle school students from low income and often from minority background. And living in rural areas, the SMILE program, Science and Math Investigative Learning Experiences, helps students improve their science and math skills in, by doing things that are fun and intellectually stimulating. And we do try to interest those students in thinking about careers in those areas. So that's a proven partnership. Just a word about the Academic Environment Support Services. And here, this will sound very familiar to you, but all of the campuses are small cities. Some of them are not even such small cities, but are towns and cities unto themselves with boundaries that flow into the surrounding communities. And so they provide for the lives of the students, faculty, staff who are there. For the students, we provide the full range of services: admissions, registration, academic advising, financial aid, accommodations for disabilities, counseling and testing, bookstores, career services, the full range of life services, residence halls. I actually had dorms on here, but having seen the light a little earlier in another presentation, we'll call them residence halls. Health services, public safety is a very big issue on our campuses, activities and athletics, child care and family programs, as our students have become somewhat older than students were in the past, and multicultural services. And then in the academic services areas, there are also changes as well. Computing and network services have become very important and expected services on the campuses. Libraries, as you may know, are highly networked now and require their own computer support, research institutes, and centers. And what is really new about student and learning services on the campuses and off is the extent to which many now do incorporate electronic means of delivery. You've seen the map, or we'll show it here shortly, that shows 143 sites around the state, but that's just physical locations where there's a downlink or there's a receive site. It may be on a community college campus that we have a partnership with. It may be an extension center office. It may be a community room in a hospital or in a shopping mall. But in addition to those sites, it is now possible, of course, to offer web-based instruction directly to the homes of our students, and more, this is the way that we are providing educational services. This frees students from those wonderful traditions of standing in long lines, and it lets them conduct their business and their learning at times and places that are convenient to their lifestyles. For off-campus students, of course, technology, including computers and email, would be the lifeline to their educational opportunity. So we estimate we have of our enrollment probably about 12,000 students in that overall enrollment headcount who have taken a course this past year, at least one course, at a receive site or in their own home, and they would be spread across the state, and some of them would be in other states than in Oregon. I'd like to turn now to my colleague, President Bernstein, who's going to talk more specifically about these matters in the context of Portland State University.
Thank you, Shirley. Dan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Hartung, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Bernstein. I'm the president of Portland State University. I think I only have one slide to present to you. I think it made it into the packet. I've had the opportunity to meet with each of you over the last couple of months, and I'm really pleased to be here to speak before you as a committee. I want to talk about what we've done at Portland State and report on our commitments that we made to you based on your investment in the new budget model and funding model last session. At that time, we said that we would do four things primarily. One, serve more students. Second, invest in programs that serve the region. Third, improve the quality of our programs. And fourth, improve our infrastructure. As you know, Portland State is Oregon's urban university, and our mission is to connect the assets of the university, that is to say, our faculty, staff, students, and facilities, to the needs of the community, to the needs of the region. And today I want to illustrate how we've taken that mission and how that mission is reflected in our students and faculty and the work that we do as a university. Portland State is now Oregon's largest university. We have approximately 20,000 enrolled students. We have the largest graduate program in the state. And Portland State is a place where access and excellence are both at home together. Our enrollment has grown about 6% over the last 6 years, and we have enrolled about 2,000 of the 4,000 new students to the OUS system. Our entering students come better prepared with higher GPAs and SAT scores, and we also are the most diverse campus in the Oregon University system. We have a number of new initiatives to attract more students of color, targeting the Afro-American and Latino communities. We also are a university that is becoming much more sensitive to the fact that students are consumers, and we're looking at ways to improve our advising system, as well as ways of assessing what we do as an institution in terms of whether we are achieving the goals that we set in the classroom and with our curriculum. In terms of our student body, we, of course, have a traditional student body. We probably have the oldest student body in the Oregon University system. But we also have a continued growth in the number of transfers for students. But equally important, we have a growing number of traditional freshmen who are coming to Portland State. We have a number of programs that are aimed at working with these young people and bringing them into the PSU community and actually attracting them to the institution. Our undergraduate program, University Studies, has received national recognition because it is a community-based learning curriculum that is required of all students attending the university. We've had over 250 institutions of higher education come to PSU to consult with us about our undergraduate program. We have cohorts of those programs, of that program, in several of the high schools around the region. One is at Grant High School, and I'm pleased to introduce today Quinella Mullen, a freshman at PSU studying psychology. Quinella participated in Grant's Freshman Inquiry Program. She enrolled at PSU with 15 credits of undergraduate general education, and she now has a 3.8 undergraduate grade point average at Portland State.
Thank you.
Congratulations. That's wonderful.
Very pleased to have you. In terms of program investment, as I said before, one of the things that we promised was that we would invest in programs that serve the region. We clearly have a priority on business, engineering, science, and technology programs. We've introduced new PhD programs in engineering. We have a new Master's of Financial Management in our School of Business. We've recently signed an affiliation agreement with Oregon Health Sciences University and OGI to expand the collaborations that we already have in existence and also to pursue new initiatives with the collaborative leading the charge. We've invested in teacher preparation cohorts including math and science and bilingual teacher education. I'm also pleased today to introduce our Dean of the School of Education, Phyllis Edmondson, who is here with us today. Also with us is a student, Stephanie Dazer, a student teacher at Clackamas High School in the Clackamas District, Senator Miller. She happens to be one of your constituents. She has a B.S. in biochemistry and molecular biology from Marquette University. She's worked as a chemist in Southeast Portland before entering PSU School of Education, and she's done a lot of volunteer work in South Central Los Angeles. So very proud of a student like Stephanie that we've been able to attract to our program. We've also made...
Excuse me, Stephanie, I really appreciate the good work you're doing. And in fact, if you have some other time, some additional time, well, your state senator could use a little tutoring. Only kidding.
You meant today a lot of tutoring.
that would fit better. Excuse me, Dan.
That's all right. We've also targeted resources in areas where we can build our strengths, such as our nationally ranked College of Urban and Public Affairs, our nationally ranked College of Graduate School of Social Work, our School of Business, which currently ranks in the top third, but with our new dean who has a clear vision to move that business school from the top third to the top quartile. In terms of improving the quality of our programs, we've worked to increase the ability to recruit, retain, and retain quality faculty. During the last session, because of the resources that we were that we received, we were able to increase faculty salaries. We've had a number of searches that have resulted in hiring superstars. In fact, I'm very pleased to inform you that we recently hired Bryant York, who is a professor of computer science at Northeastern University. He is the sixth African-American to receive a Ph.D. in computer science. He holds two master's degrees and will be coming to teach in our School of Engineering in the fall. So we're very very pleased that we were able to attract someone like Brian to PSU. But we were only able to do that. We were only able to retain good people because of the targeted investments that we made as a result of the investment that you made in higher education last session.
Dan, excuse me. I know OGI has a master's degree in computer software engineering, I guess. So do you collaborate with OGI?
Yes, that's a degree that we have.
So the gentleman you just mentioned will be
exactly
instructing out there also?
Right, right. We have a number of faculty that instruct both at OGI and PSU. In fact, most of our students don't even know whether they're taking a course from a PSU instructor or an OGI instructor in many instances.
Great.
One measure of quality of research, of course, of faculty research is productivity. And at PSU, our grant and contract research funding is up about 44% in the last 4 years, which is one of the highest rates of increase in the country. I'd also at this point like to introduce the chairman of our psychology department, Professor Keith Kaufman. Keith came to PSU in 1998. He's actively involved in research focusing on the prevention of child sexual abuse. He received a $700,000 grant from the Center for Disease Control, the first ever study of this kind funded by the center. And Dr. Kaufman has also garnered about $2 million in research funding over the last 10 years and received the Gould Weisinger Award for research excellence, and we're very proud to have him as a member of our faculty as well. And then another faculty member that many of you may have had some contact with, Professor Mark Stisma, who teaches in our environmental studies program. Again, represent Senator Miller, this is just a coincidence, but he's also a constituent, of course. Mark directs our Center for Lakes and Reservoirs. He has received grants from local, state, and federal governments, as well as from private corporations. In other words, he's really our weeds expert. And yesterday I was embarrassed to find out that my hometown, Richmond, California, is actually one of the leading contributors of weeds to the Columbia River. So on behalf of Richmond, I apologize to all of you. But Mark has been a valuable member of our faculty, and for any of you who have lakes or rivers in your districts, Mark, I'm sure, has been instrumental in terms of working there. We've also been able, and finally, we've been able to invest in infrastructure. At PSU, we have about $80 million of deferred maintenance, and as a result of the investments that you made last session, we were able to invest in the renovation of our science laboratories, the development of new facilities for engineering. We purchased the new University Center building and opened the new Urban Center and Plaza, which will welcome the streetcar July 20th of this year, and we're looking forward to that new addition to our campus as well. The new budget model and funding gave us the opportunity to change the way we do business at PSU, and I think we've responded. The future is very exciting for us as an institution, but our vision requires the ability to continue to grow. We need to be able to serve the region's students who want and can benefit from a college education. The future also requires us to better serve the needs of industry, and our upcoming capital campaign, which is in its quiet phase, which has a focus on engineering, business, science, and technology, will clearly put us in a better position to be more responsive to the needs of industry. I think we are on the right track. We need your continued investment. I want to thank you again for your investment last session. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Dan, very much. I know you'll be back before us, and so we'll hold off and move right along because we do have to be done by 3 o'clock. And Sean Hempel, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Sean Hempel, a senior at the Oregon Institute of Technology in Klamath Falls.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also currently serving a two-year term, my second year of a two-year term on the board as one of two student members. I've enjoyed this experience, and I believe I've contributed a unique perspective to the board's deliberations, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. And this has already been talked about, but I just want to reiterate that in business, when you talk about the bottom line, you're talking about money. But in higher ed, when you talk about the bottom line, you're talking about students. And I believe that my role on the board is to ensure that students are always the bottom line. So the perspective that I want to share with you today is that of a customer, of a student. And because I'm not very comfortable with being 30,000 feet in the air, I'm going to try to bring it down a little bit. So I would like to take this opportunity to speak to the committee today about programs and services at OIT, one of Oregon's seven public universities, the one that I attend. At OIT, I'm pursuing my bachelor's degree in software engineering technology. It's an exciting field, and I believe I have a pretty bright future ahead of me. And for people who may be less familiar with OIT's programs, you should know that we not only receive an excellent technical education from the Polytechnical Institute, but we also get a rigorous general education as well. And I think that those two complementary aspects of the program will serve me well into the future. Combined, they have given me a strong background in critical thinking, problem solving, and communication skills. In addition to academic benefits of higher ed, though, college has greatly enhanced other aspects of my life. My experiences with student government, for which I'm currently the president of the Associated Students at OIT, my campus clubs and organizations, and obviously the Board of Higher Ed, have shown me the importance of giving back to the community. And I know that I'm going to carry this value of volunteerism with me throughout my life in the workplace and in the communities. One of the unique aspects of programs at OIT is the senior project. It requires each student to take a project from beginning to end of the production cycle. That includes problem analysis, documentation, implementation, testing, and hopefully product release. My senior project involves developing a computer application to keep records of backflow prevention devices or irrigation systems. I'm creating software for the Palm Pilots, which is this guy, and without him I wouldn't know where I was ever. so that they can be used by field engineers to input, store, and retrieve data. And then the billing and reports are generated automatically for the testing company. And I appreciate the tremendous opportunity that this gives me to apply what I've learned in the classroom to a real-world situation. And I'm done, so I want to thank everyone for the opportunity to serve on the board. I want, members of the committee, I want to thank you for your time today, and I would be pleased to answer any questions you have for me as a student or as a board member.
John, nice presentation. Where'd you go to high school?
McNary in Kaiser.
McNary?
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. And do you expect to pursue a master's or a doctoral degree, or are you going to go right to work out of school?
Both.
Okay.
Hopefully.
Does ESI have a campus at Klamath Falls?
ESI has just built a new complex. We're agreed to build a new...
It's operating. Producing product for... All right.
In Klamath Falls. I'm a little behind.
Yeah. Excuse me, Don, will you be... Do you have... training programs for the students at OIT, for instance, do you utilize any of those students in your...
We have a number of OIT graduates that work with us.
Okay.
A history of a pretty active interaction, even over the distance, because of their laser-based program. And we expect that to be nothing but enhanced as we bring the faculty.
Well, I sure wish you good luck on that. I thought it was just great when you established that campus down there, because... As you know, in Washington County, we have plenty of high tech, and it'd be nice to spread it around. So, thank you very much, Ron. Other questions or comments? Okay, Jim Willis.
We're going to conclude, Chairman Hartung, with a different take on this. Jim Willis is the, along with Herb Ashkenazi, who most of you know from Albany, sure, longest serving member on our board.
Oh.
8 years, he's concluding 8 years, and just by coincidence, his tenure on the board spans this period of change in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost no one better prepared to talk about that in the context of change in Oregon than Jim Willis, who in his other life is a consultant in business, and he just happens to be in Oregon today.
Good. Jim, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Willis. I'm a member of the State Board of Higher Education. I've been serving on the board since 1993. This will be my last year off the board here in June. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to speak with you today about some of the policies implemented by the Oregon University System over the past several years. We've been carefully tracking the changing context of the state and how it relates to higher education. This includes learners who are more heterogeneous. There are as many diverse needs as there are students. The number of high school graduates continues to increase, as do the proportion seeking a post-secondary education. Oregon has shifted, as we've said earlier, from a timber-based to a technology-based economy, resulting in exponential job growth. But another outcome is uneven prosperity in different regions of the state. Emerging from this new economy are enhanced means of communications. The infrastructure for telecommunications continue to expand, resulting in greater, faster access to information. The next slide highlights several milestones made by the board and the system since the early 1990s in response to the changing context of how post-secondary education is delivered and received. In 1993, the 2010 advisory panel, of which I was a member, created a vision for how post-secondary education should be by the year 2010. Over the past several years, we've continued to reference this document as it laid the groundwork for what we as a board see as the future of higher education in Oregon. Board-appointed solution teams comprised of board members, top administrative staff, and members of the public were formed in 1996 to examine how the system was conducting its business. Each came back to the board with a report on what was being done well and areas that needed improvement. The board and campuses later implemented many of the suggestions articulated in those reports. In 1997, the board adopted four broad goals that were later enacted into law through Senate Bill 919. The goals include access, cost effectiveness, employability, and quality. These goals are always first and foremost by the board and staff when considering virtually anything, as well as in our strategic planning discussions. Also in 1997, several governor's task force reports were released relating to higher education. These comprehensive reports led us to several major changes in how we do business. Performance indicators, our benchmarks for success in the system, were identified. One of the most notable was the implementation of a new resource allocation model in 1998. The model, which is vastly different from the old budget system, allows the dollars to follow the student. This entrepreneurial shift approach shifted the campus paradigm to a more competitive process. As a result, campuses began designing processes that included allowed them to better and more quickly respond to market needs. Building on the system's commitment to better respond to the state's changing environment, last year, an engineering initiative was approved by the state board in collaboration with industry. A plan was devised to dramatically increase, in fact double, the number of engineering and computer science graduates over the next several years. In addition, Oregon State University is now designated to become a top tier, or actually a tier one, College of Engineering by the year 2010. These ambitious goals are surely to be met given the enthusiasm of all the parties involved. Also, thanks to the budget granted to OUS by the legislature in 99, the first performance incentive awards were awarded to campuses for their efforts. Finally, as you know, a truly monumental decision came last month when the board voted to award management of a branch campus in Central Oregon to Oregon State University. There are still several hurdles remaining, but the board feels confident that access to post-secondary education to an underserved area of the state will become a reality in the near future. So how did we get to this point? First, intensive strategic planning by the board, beginning with the 2010 advisory panel report. The mandate set forth in SB 919 further led us to making some important strides in how we do business. The development of performance measures provide a way for us all to see just how well we're doing. And based on a recent report released by Davison Hibbetts in Citizens Perceptions, I'd say we're doing a pretty good job. But we still have a lot to do. The 2010 advisory panel envisioned numerous shifts in how the system operates. These included partnerships and seamless collaboration with other institutions and with community colleges, a responsive, more entrepreneurial system, clear performance expectations, a continuum of programs and governmental and structural changes. The Board of Higher Education set its sights on achieving these goals. As a member of the panel, as well as a member of the board, I can say that the system has undergone dramatic changes, due mainly in part to the hard work of members of the board and the system staff. The rewards of the board's work has been realized in many ways. Our efforts to become more responsive and customer service oriented have resulted in increased investments by the state, both public and private. OUS now guarantees access at specified support levels. And finally, all the institution mission statements have been reviewed from a strategic standpoint so they better align with each other and provide a clearer vision for how each campus fits into the system as a whole. A major focus, though, of the board's system strategic planning committee, the committee that I chair, has been defining in this new way of conducting business the role of the board and balancing that with the campus autonomy and responsibility. The board has transitioned itself to a much more policy-oriented body than it did even 10 years ago and sees itself now as one that provides general oversight and direction. Campuses, on the other hand, are now more responsible for creating programs and partnerships, as well as working directly on academic processes. SB 919 not only outlined the board's four overarching goals, but listed several requirements. Created in partnership with the 1997 legislature, the board committed to the following: creation of accountability and performance measures, continued work on proficiency-based admission standards that are aligned with the K-12 reform efforts, offer the broadest access to educational services, work toward a more seamless system of credit transfer between OUS institutions and community colleges, increase the number of college-to-work transition experiences for students, and develop accelerated baccalaureate models. I think I can say that the Board of Higher Education has successfully implemented systems in all of these areas, and I would like to be able to say, and I think I can say with confidence, that the Oregon University system is a continuing success story. And I think I'm going to leave the board knowing that it is continuing to be successful.
Thank you very much, Jim. 8 years on the Board of Higher Education, that is a project, I know. If you're...
You can say sentence anyway.
Yeah. If you're going to have withdrawal pains, I've got a couple of good boards that could sure use you. excuse me, but what is your work again? What do you do?
I was actually, when I came on the board, I was the chief executive officer for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde.
Okay.
And left there in 95, and I do consulting work for Indian tribes.
Okay.
I have a small consulting firm, and
terrific.
That's what I do.
And happened to be in Oregon today.
Well, that's wonderful.
That's great.
Yeah. Okay,
thank
Joe,
you.
What next?
Well, we're going to conclude today with something really very different. Adam Davis of Davis & Hibbetts, the Portland firm, which surveys Oregonians and their opinions,
mm-hmm.
has, as recently as January of this year, done a survey with respect to the university system and questions that he put to Oregonians. And we thought it might be useful in terms of this scene setting to share that with you, and that will conclude today's presentation, and we'll begin tomorrow to finish the overview.
Good. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Adam Davis. I'm a partner in the public opinion and communications research firm Davis and Hibbetts. And I don't know if it's perfect timing, I'm also a PSU alum. And in fact, Tim and I met on the incidental fee committee when we were both students at PSU. So, Joe, perfect timing. What I'd like to do is share with you the results of a study we recently completed for the Oregon University system. As Joe said, this is really a benchmark study of a study that really began back in 1993 with the baseline we've conducted in 93, 99, and again in the year 2001. The most recent survey consisted of a sample of 600 randomly selected Oregon voters. So it's a proportional sample across the state of Oregon. What I'd like to do is begin by just saying this. I've had an opportunity, I consider it a privilege, to meet with many, many, in fact, hundreds of focus groups of Oregonians over the years. I've had an opportunity to do a lot of surveys. I've been doing this work since 1977. Tim and I tend to specialize in planning public policy kinds of projects. I can tell you this for sure, that over the years, Oregonians are appreciating the connection that exists more and more between higher education and the quality of the future of this state and its economy. So I kind of started this presentation off with just giving you a feeling for how Oregonians feel about Oregon and the direction it's headed. And the first slide shows here that Oregonians, 62% feel the state is headed in the right direction. Now, this was conducted in January. A lot of things have happened since January. Look down in California, we have rolling blackouts. You can take a look at the stock averages. They've gone down. I can tell you that these results would be a little different if we were to go out and ask Oregonians right now how they feel about the direction of Oregon. In fact, that's down from 4% from when we conducted the study in 1999. Mm. So it's 66% then, it's 62% in January. And I do have other data that's in the public domain that suggests it's slipping a little bit more. It's softening, but still it's an optimistic viewpoint. How do you view the future economic conditions in Oregon? Really, we put 5 years on that. In 5 years, how do you view the future economic conditions in Oregon? About the same, 45%, 30% saying better, 21% saying worse. Again, a little softening in the last few months. And I want to emphasize that. I'm not talking about drastic drops here, okay? Because as much as the stock market is really having an impact on people's attitudes, you're still hearing a lot of news about the fundamentals of the economy are still pretty darn good. And that's holding up in this kind of percentages, because these kind of percentages, we don't see too big of a drop. By the way, the more education a person had, the more likely they would say that they felt the future economic conditions in Oregon would be better. Moving on to a question about, well, college education be important in 5 years. Look at this figure, 78% of Oregonians saying that it will be more important in 5 years, a college education. And this is up from 67% in 1999. That is a significant shift, 67% in 1999 to 78% now. How satisfied are you with Oregon public university education? I believe the handout has a weird one there, 0.5. That's really 50%. If you could make that change, I'd appreciate it. But you're having 90% of the people saying that they are somewhat or very satisfied with the Oregon public university system. How do our public universities compare in quality with others? About equal, 6 out of 10 people we talked to said about equal, 25% better, 9% worse. What do you think about the tuition at Oregon's public universities? 45% of the people we spoke with in January said they felt it was too high, 36% about right, 3% don't know, 16% don't know, and 3% too low. What's your view of public higher education in Oregon? We gave them two statements. One statement said we want that system to be able to compete with the nation's best, and the other statement simply said, hey, listen, we'd be satisfied with just being good. That's okay for Oregon. It's not important that we be great. And you can see overwhelmingly that 86% of the people said that they want to compete with the nation's best. This is another significant change that I want to point out to you. It was 78% in 99. Now it's 86%. So again, you can see this shift in this attitude towards public education continuing. Are our public universities doing a better job than 5 years ago? 34% saying better compared to 23% in 1999, okay, 2 years ago. And finally, what percent of the university's budget comes from tax dollars? I think the interesting thing here is take a look at the 23% who said, geez, I have no idea. And the rest of the people, when you look at that 3%, 11, 22, 27, 12, 2, pretty much all over the map, with the modal response being about 27%, saying about 50%. One thing I want to conclude with is this. Remember, the sample for the study was registered voters. Now, if we sampled taxpayers who aren't necessarily registered voters, we would have picked up what? More younger people. Voter samples tend to skew towards older age groups. So one thing to keep in mind is that in other work we've done, we have seen that the younger age groups tend to be even more supportive of higher education. So if anything, these percentages are probably underrepresenting the picture if you were to look beyond registered voters to taxpayers, more of a general population kind of sample. And I'll conclude my remarks with that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do you have any sense of what the public thinks about our independent institutions of higher ed, or do you think there's any that you can gather anything from what your polling did? Did you ever have any trouble your pollsters identify or separating the independent from the public?
Very good question, Mr. Chairman, and we were very careful with our respondents to make it very clear what we were talking about. We were talking about the state system, we were talking about state colleges and universities, not community colleges and not private colleges. Very good question.
Thank you, Senator.
My question was whether you distinguish between OUS and community colleges, and just answer that.
Right.
Are you going to do another poll, Joe? Or?
Oh, yes, sir.
Well, when are you going to do that?
Well, this is about every 2 years.
Right.
Interesting.
In the next poll you do, this request comes from our colleague, the senator from Lake Oswego, and he's too bashful to ask about, but ask people what they think about self-service gas.
A little piggyback question, huh?
We're not quite sure how to tack that on, Senator, but we'll work on it.
Yeah.
Members of the committee, thank you. That's the first day part of the overview, and we'll be back to conclude tomorrow.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much.
For your time.
There's
no other business. Let's see, members, those of you who are on the full Ways and Means, Friday has been canceled, but we're going to do that Thursday at 8 o'clock instead.
Thursday at
8? Yeah.
Thursday at 8.
And then we go to our subs at 8:30, so we obviously don't have any other business come before the committee. If not, we are adjourned.